If you would like to follow along with what Brother Hall has selected this evening, it'll be from 1 Kings chapter 16. I will be reading from the English Standard Version. I'll give you a moment to either turn in your printed word or find it in your technology. 1 Kings chapter 16, and I will be reading verses 29 through 34. I'll give you just a moment to get there. In the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, Ahab the son of Omri began to reign over Israel, and Ahab the son of Omri reigned over Israel in Samaria 22 years. And Ahab the son of Omri did evil in the sight of the Lord more than all who were before him. And as it had been a light thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, he took for his wife Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and went and served Baal and worshipped him. He erected an altar for Baal in the house of Baal, which he built in Samaria. And Ahab made an Asherah. Ahab did more to provoke the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger than all of the kings of Israel who were before him. In his days, Hiel of Bethel built Jericho. He laid its foundation at the cost of Abram, his firstborn, and set up its gates at the cost of his youngest son, Segub, who, according to the word of the Lord, which he spoke by Joshua, the son of Nun.
As we have said, we're going to be looking at Elijah in tonight's lesson. Why would you think we're going to be looking at Elijah? Is there anything special about him? There's a lot of prophets in the Bible. Why Elijah? Any thoughts come to your mind? Yes. Of course. Yeah. Yes. Oh. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Oh. Okay. Well, did you bring any with you to let us try them out? Okay. Danny, she was just following up on the mandrake issue last night and was reporting on that. Meredith? Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, of course, whether it's grounded in science or not, that was the thinking of that day, I'm sure, was it was something that would encourage a relationship and encourage offspring as well. So how that ties in with the hallucinatory aspect, I don't know. But anyway, very interesting. Thank you for following up on that. And if you could really bring some in, that would be even better. So, all right, we are talking about Elijah. Elijah, of course, stands out because, he's one of the two that were transfigured with Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration. That says something big about Elijah, doesn't it? And also, you know, you could talk about how Malachi gives the prophecy at the very end of the Old Testament about how Elijah will come, and we'll get into some of that as well. But what is it about this man? What stands out about him? And if you have looked at the book, if you were able to get a copy of that, you'll see that the key idea is the idea of commitment, that Elijah was a committed individual. In fact, the focus statement for the lesson says it this way: Elijah bravely stood against the prophets of Baal to clear the trail for the Messiah to come. And that's a good way of summarizing what we're going to be talking about this evening. We're going to focus mostly on 1 Kings 17, not all of 17, and then most of chapter 18. That's going to be really where we're going to really focus our thinking tonight. But it's interesting that with a character so significant in the Bible, he is introduced as he is in 1 Kings chapter 17 and verse 1. Now Elijah, the Tishbite of Tishbe in Gilead, said to Ahab, "As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, before whom I stand, there shall be neither dew nor rain these years except by my word." Now that's a very abrupt entrance, isn't it? In a television series or a movie, you would not introduce a main character like that. Pow, right there he is, making a very big statement. But that's how we're introduced to Elijah. We know nothing about his background. We know nothing about what occupation he might have had, if any, before he was called to be a prophet of God. We do know that he wore rough clothing. There was one occasion where the king was told, "There's a man out there saying this." And he said, "What does he look like?" "Well, he's dressed in rough clothing and wearing a leather belt." And, "Oh, that's Elijah." So he was distinctive in appearance. And that also connects with John the Baptist that we're going to be talking about Wednesday night. So we don't know a lot about him. But one thing we get really clearly, I mean, really, you can't miss this, is that he was a bold, dedicated individual. He did not back down to anybody. Well, there is a time that he kind of does with Jezebel, and of course, we're not going to talk about that incident tonight. But for the most part, he holds his ground, he does what the Lord tells him to do, and, you know, because of that, things, at least the people know clearly who God is. Well, let's go back to the passage Randy read for just a few moments in 1 Kings 16. 1 Kings 16, verses 29 through 34. And the reason we're doing this is we need to understand how bad things had gotten in Israel. Now, when I say Israel, I'm talking about the northern kingdom. The kingdom of Israel now is divided. Solomon is gone. Rehoboam, his son, has already done his foolish things. And now, Jeroboam. Is that right? Yeah, Jeroboam, the one that led the 10 tribes in a different direction. So anyway, the kingdom now is split. And so we're now down to the point of looking at Ahab. And most of us, if we know anything about Ahab, will say, "Ooh, it's not going to be good." Well, it's not. In the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, Ahab the son of Omri began to reign over Israel. And Ahab the son of Omri reigned over Israel and Samaria 22 years. And Ahab the son of Omri did evil in the sight of the Lord more than all who were before him. Now, we already are getting a sense that things have really continued downhill. In fact, they're not yet at their lowest point. Things will get even worse, but it's getting really bad, and that's the idea. Now, verse 31, "And as if it had been a light thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, he took for his wife Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and went and served Baal and worshipped him. He erected an altar for Baal in the house of Baal, which he built in Samaria, and Ahab made an Asherah. Ahab did more to provoke the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger than all the kings of Israel who were before him." A lot of things there, but let me just pick out a couple of things. One, the Sidonians. Do you know anything about the Sidonians? Who were these people? Do you know the leading cities of it? Pardon? Sidon, of course. Tyre is one of the cities there. It is a place where idolatry is rampant. And of course, that's true of much of the area around Israel. Idolatry is rampant. And so, despite the fact that God had told, you know, Israel to keep yourselves separate from non-Israelites, do not join them in doing the things that they do, the idolatry and so forth, well, here goes Ahab, and he takes Jezebel, the daughter of the king of Sidon, as his wife. Now, it's interesting, and I didn't realize this until I got into this study, the name Ethbaal. That has significance, and it probably is mentioned for a reason. Literally, I'm told it means Baal is alive. Baal is alive. In other words, it was a proclamation that Baal is a true God, and he is somebody that needs to be feared and served and worshiped. And that, of course, is what their idolatry was all about. Now, keep in mind, there is another name here that we need to recognize the meaning of, and that is Elijah. Do you know the name, the meaning of Elijah's name? God, the Yahweh is my God. Yah is my God, to be more exact. And you can see that Elijah, the singular for God, and Yah, the shortened form of Yahweh. And so it means, in effect, Yahweh is my God. So you've got two different gods coming to head in this section. And I think that's a whole lot of the reason why we're going to be looking at this confrontation in chapter 18. You have a test. Well, let's see if Baal really is alive. Let's see if he really is powerful. And Elijah, even though he does this at great personal risk, is going to do what the Lord tells him to do. So we're seeing that Ahab is very bad. He has gotten into a lot of things. And then there's this curious verse 34, that kind of departs a little bit, but I think it's given as another insight into how bad things were at that time. Verse 34 of chapter 16, 1 Kings. In his days, Hiel of Bethel built Jericho. Now, Jericho, as you remember, was within the borders of the kingdom. It was the first city that they came to. And yet, Joshua had pronounced a curse when they conquered Jericho and said, you know, let this city never be built again. And I believe there was a curse on the firstborn of whoever did that. Well, we're told here, in this day, Hiel of Bethel built Jericho. He laid its foundation at the cost of Abiram, his firstborn, and set up its gates at the cost of his youngest son, Segub, according to the word of the Lord, which he spoke by Joshua, the son of Nun. So this man, whoever he is, we're not told much about him, he built Jericho, the foundation, that is the beginning, cost him his firstborn son, and the gates, which would be the final act of building the city, cost him his youngest son. Now there's considerable discussion among scholars, was this God that killed them, you know, as a way of fulfilling that curse that had been put on the city, or was this Hiel himself offering his sons as sacrifices? Now, why would we even say that? Because that's some of the idolatry of that area. In fact, let's go back to chapter 11 for just a moment. 1 Kings chapter 11, and look at verse 7. And we're going to look at a king that we normally don't think of as being too bad. But look at this. I mean, this is sad. 1 Kings 11, verse 7, then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, and for Molech, the abomination of the Ammonites, on the mountain east of Jerusalem. This is Solomon, the son of King David, a man after God's own heart, building high places, places of worship for these idols. And do you know anything about Molech or Chemosh? They were especially notorious for child sacrifice. They would heat up the idol till it was red hot and then lay the child in the arms, the outstretched arms of the idol. And that was their offering to that god. Now, taking that back now to 1 Kings 16, are we to read into that that Heal, in his building of the city of Jericho, sacrificed his own sons? That very well could be. We don't know. It could be God fulfilling the curse. But nonetheless, it shows you just how bad things have gotten at the time that Elijah appears on the scene. And then in chapter 17 and verse 1, the very next verse, that's where Elijah comes onto the scene. First time we've met him. And what is he saying? Well, look again at verse 1, 1 Kings 17. As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, before whom I stand, there shall be neither dew nor rain these years except by my word. This is something God had told him to do. You go to Ahab and you prophesy that there will be no more rain, not even any dew, until I say so. And how long a period is it? These years. So it's going to be a long time. And things are going to get really bad. Now, why would he make a prophecy like that? Why would he make a prophecy that would hurt a lot of people? Punishment probably is a lot of it. There's another one that goes to the idol that we're talking about, the main idol, and that is Baal. Baal was regarded by those who worshipped him as the god of lightning. And when you got lightning and thunder, you normally have some rain that comes along as well. And so they looked to Baal as the source of what was needed to grow their crops. So Elijah is challenging Baal, in effect. That's what he's doing, in effect. He's saying, I challenge Baal, and there will be no rain until I say so. So Elijah, whose very name means Yahweh is my God, he is now pitted against Baal. And we're going to see who has the greater power. And then we go on. Let's go on in verses 2 through 7. We know this pretty well. This is a story that we learned in Sunday school probably, where God tells him to go dwell by the brook Cherith, which is east of the Jordan. And in fact, that is also in the land of the Sidonians, it appears, or somewhere in that vicinity. Well, Zarephath is definitely down below when we read about the widow. But things get so bad, even that brook dries up where God is providing for him. So God sends him to this widow of Zarephath, and that's in verses 8 through 16, which we're not going to read tonight. But there you see we have God's provision. We talked about this in a sermon on Mother's Day, in fact. This widow apparently had some faith because she was willing to make Elijah a little cake out of the last bit of flour and oil that she had available, and all because he had said, if you do that, then God's going to provide for you. And so she took him at his word. She did that by faith, and God took care of her and her household for many days, it says. So God is providing for Elijah, and all of this, it's got to be hard on Elijah too. You know, we don't know anything about his family. Did he have family back home? Did he ever marry? We don't know. But he's having to be away because his life is in danger. Why would his life be in danger? Okay. He's the one that caused this drought. So maybe if we get him back and torture him, he'll do something and get the rain to come back, and then we'll get rid of him completely. And then, as we're going to see, it wasn't a good thing to be a prophet of the true God at that time. We'll get to that here in just a little bit. So God has sent him to do what he does. And let's go now to chapter 18. Let's look at the beginning of this confrontation between Elijah and the prophets of Baal, because here we're really going to see the commitment of this prophet. Verses 1 and 2. After many days, the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year. Notice we're now in the third year of this drought. Can you imagine? I mean, we start really complaining after a month of no rain, or a couple of months. I mean, it's getting really bad after a couple of months. We're going to have to start conserving water. Can't water our lawns anymore. Can't wash our cars. And it gets really bad from there on. You don't have crops. You don't have food. So it's the third year. And God says, go, show yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain upon the earth. That's, again, a tough command if you're thinking the way we normally think. I mean, this is a wicked king. I have prophesied something that is hurting him and all of his nation. They know that I'm against Baal, and you're telling me to go present myself to the king? But, verse 2, so Elijah went to show himself to Ahab. Now the famine was severe in Samaria. Now, God may have understood that this was a very difficult challenge, because it's not like he's sending Elijah into the castle. You know, he has to walk past all the guards with their spears and all that. Instead, he meets Ahab and one of his servants out in the field. And that's what we're going to read about next. Let's look at verses 3 and following. Ahab called Obadiah, who was over the household. Now, this is not the prophet Obadiah, as far as we know. I'm pretty sure it's not. Now, Obadiah feared the Lord greatly. And when Jezebel cut off the prophets of the Lord, Obadiah took 100 prophets and hid them by fifties in a cave and fed them with bread and water. Ahab said to Obadiah, go through the land to all the springs of water, to all the valleys. Perhaps we may find grass and save the horses and mules alive and not lose some of the animals. So they divided the land between them to pass through it. Ahab went in one direction by himself, and Obadiah went in another direction by himself. And I think this kind of shows us how desperate things were getting when the king himself gets out to start looking for grass or something to feed the animals. Well, he takes with him a servant, of course, Obadiah, but now they're splitting up. They're going to go in different directions and look for something that may sustain their horses and other livestock. And it's now, not in the palace. You know, that would be a very intimidating situation. And maybe God makes this allowance. He says, okay, I'm going to make it a little easier for you, Elijah. Now, I'm speculating here, I'll freely admit. But he's allowing him to meet them in a safer area. And that's what we find. Well, we'll not read verses 7 and following for now, but Elijah comes up upon Obadiah. He says, go tell your master that I'm going to see him. And Obadiah says, what have I done to you? I mean, you're going to disappear. God's going to take you away. And then I'll bring the king here and you're not there and he'll kill me. What have I done to offend you? That, I think, says something about the anger of Ahab, how dangerous a man he could be. And Elijah says, no, don't worry about it. I assure you. In fact, let's read the very words that he uses, and I believe that's in verse 15. 1 Kings chapter 18 and verse 15, Elijah said, as the Lord of hosts lives, before whom I stand, I will surely show myself to him today. What has Elijah just done? He has taken an oath. He has made a vow that as surely as God lives, I promise you I'll be there. And so that gives Obadiah a little peace of mind, and he goes to tell the king that Elijah is here. And so now in verse 17, when Ahab saw Elijah, Ahab said to him, is it you, O troubler of Israel? And I love the comeback of Elijah. Elijah answered, I have not troubled Israel, but you have, and your father's house, because you have abandoned the commandments of the Lord and followed the Baals. Now you're talking to the king. You're talking to the man that has the power of putting people to death on the spot. But Elijah doesn't hold back. He's very clear. He says, you're the troubler of Israel. You're the one that has brought the Baals into Israel. You have forsaken the commandments of God. I'm not the troubler of Israel. You are. And sometimes that's what we have to do when people depart from the will of God. We have to let them know, no, you have done wrong by forsaking what God has shown us. And that's what Elijah does right here. So Elijah now proposes this contest, and we're going to read verse 19. Now therefore send and gather all Israel to me at Mount Carmel, and the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. So you're talking about 850 prophets of idols there on the other side. And how many we got on this side? One. And that's kind of intimidating again, isn't it? And then add to that what we find in the next verse, verse 20. So Ahab sent to all the people of Israel and gathered the prophets together at Mount Carmel, and Elijah came near to all the people and said. So you've got a lot of people there too. Now, is it literally all the people? Probably not. There are elderly people that can't make that journey, and people that live far enough away, they couldn't get there in time. But there's a big crowd there too. And wow, you talk about courage. Elijah's got to have a ton of it. In fact, I point that out on your sheet if you want to look at that section called Elijah's Commitment, seen in these observations. Number one, Obadiah, we didn't read that part, I'm sorry, we should have. Elijah has been the object of an intense manhunt for quite some time. Obadiah said, the king's been going all over the place making people swear that they have not seen you. You are a wanted man. You're the most wanted. Your picture's in every post office in the land, Elijah. And then chapter 18, verse 4, as we've already seen, Jezebel had cut off the prophets of the Lord, which meant if Obadiah wanted any of them to live, he had to hide them, and he did. And that put himself at risk in doing so. And then we also see in verse 13 that Jezebel had killed many of the prophets of the Lord. And again, you're getting the gist of what's going on in the land. She is purging the land of anything except Baal worshipers. She doesn't want anything left except Baal worshipers. And again, that's one way that we can tell how much courage it took for Elijah to do what he did. And then, as we saw there in verses 17 through 20, he doesn't back down from Ahab. In fact, he proposes that we all come together on Mount Carmel, which, by the way, is almost definitely, I don't think it's definite, but it's pretty certain this was a very common area for worship of Baal. It is a very high place. It is, you know, a place, and the high places, you read about those often in the Old Testament, that's where you would go to get close to the gods, if you thought like that. And so you wanted the highest place of all, and Mount Carmel was one of those places. So Elijah proposed this. Now here we are, all of these people, probably thousands of people, and one man who is standing in the gap, and that's Elijah the prophet. You talk about commitment, there we have it. Now let's look at verse 21. This is a very interesting thought. 1 Kings 18, verse 21. Elijah came near to all the people and said, how long will you go limping between two different opinions? Limping between two different opinions? Well, that's a good translation of it, actually, because it is the same word that describes Mephibosheth, who was a son of Jonathan, a grandson of King Saul that David took into his home. He was lame, and it said that that's how he got about, by limping, apparently. And there's a couple of other instances of it as well. It's something that would disqualify a Levite from being a priest in the temple. He would not be able to serve in the temple if he had a defect in his leg. And so that's the word that Elijah uses there. And it's like this: how long are you going to go about? And I did this before I got that new knee, if you remember those days. How long will you go limping about between two opinions? What are the two opinions he's talking about? Jehovah, Yahweh, or Baal? And there were those that thought, well, we can do both. You know, we'll serve both of them. Kind of like in Acts chapter 17, when Paul comes into Athens and sees the idol set up for the unknown God. Well, let's make sure we've got them all covered. Don't want to leave any of them out. And that's kind of what we're looking at here. They're saying, well, you know, we kind of see where Baal might be good, and, you know, Yahweh's been a good God to us, so we'll try to play both sides of the fence. And Elijah's challenging them. Are you going to keep on? How long are you going to do this? And what's the response that he gets? What do they say back to him? They don't say anything back to him. They're not willing to commit. See that idea of commitment? They're not willing to commit. But Elijah says, you got to make a choice, and I'm about to help you make that choice. So, here's where the contest begins. And he says in verse 22, Elijah said to the people, I only am left a prophet of the Lord. That's an exaggeration. We've already read where Obadiah had hidden 100 of them. And, you know, it's like when you go to chapter 19 and he's in the cave and he says, I'm the only one left. Elijah, you know, he probably had some stress on him, and that caused him to exaggerate sometimes. But he said, I only am left a prophet of the Lord, but Baal's prophets are 450 men. Let two bulls be given to us. Let them choose one bull for themselves, cut it in pieces, lay it on the wood, but put no fire to it. And I'll do the same thing, and then we'll call upon our gods, and we'll see if either one of them are true gods. Yeah, it's a simple thing, isn't it? A simple proposal. You prepare your sacrifice over there. You put your hamburgers on the grill. I'll put my hamburgers on the grill. And whoever's grill starts up by itself, you're the winner. That's kind of the idea. It's trivializing it, of course. But they start out. He says, you go first. I want to see you do your job. And so they do. They put their bull, they chop it up, they put it on the altar, on the wood, and then they start calling out for Baal. And let's look at, look at verse 26. They took the bull that was given them, they prepared it, called upon the name of Baal from morning until noon, saying, O Baal, answer us. But look at this, there was no voice. No one answered. And they limped around the altar that they had made. I don't know why that says that. I don't know if that was their normal custom of calling upon Baal. You know, maybe if he thinks they're injured, he'll have pity on them and come to their aid quicker. Or maybe they have thrown their hip out of joint by all their shenanigans. I don't know. But they're limping around the altar, just like Elijah said, how long are you going to limp between two opinions? And they're getting nowhere. They're getting no response. And that's where Elijah begins to have fun. Verse 27. At noon, Elijah mocked them, saying, cry aloud, for he is a god. Either he is musing or he is relieving himself. I think the King James Version says he has gone aside, something like that. Has anybody got the King James? He's what? On a journey? Yeah. Well, you know, what he's saying is maybe he had to go, you know, to the restroom and he just had to stay a while. That's really what he's saying. He's saying maybe your God is unavailable and can't take the phone right now, or he is on a journey, or perhaps he is asleep and must be awakened. In other words, this is a God that's not always there for you, is he? I mean, you're not having any luck. You better try a little harder. You better cry a little louder. Maybe that will work. And then notice how they respond to that. Verse 28, they cried aloud and cut themselves after their custom with swords and lances until the blood gushed out upon them. I was going to give you the YouTube video of this, but I thought it probably wasn't a good thing. Actually, there is no YouTube video of it that I'm aware of. But they would do extreme things. And it's really, is that the kind of God you serve that wants to see human blood in order to get his attention? I don't want to serve a God like that. But that's what they think, apparently. And they cut themselves until the blood gushed out upon them. And as midday passed, they raved on until the time of the offering of the oblation. But there was no voice. No one answered. No one paid attention. Why? Because there is no God behind Baal. It's a wooden or a metal statue. And by the way, I didn't mention this, the Asherah. We read about that as well. The Asherah was another form of an idol. We're not real clear on exactly what it looked like. It was probably made out of a tree. Might have looked something like a totem pole. Because it does appear they were made of trees. They are sometimes referred to as the groves. But it was another idol, whatever it was. So these idols, they're not helping. There's no rain, there's no fire that comes down out of heaven. And so these gods aren't helping us at all. Verse 30. Then Elijah said to all the people, "Come near to me." And all the people came near to him. And he repaired the altar of the Lord that had been thrown down. Elijah took 12 stones according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord came, saying, "Israel shall be your name." And that's what Danny talked with us about last night, the renaming of Jacob and how he would be a chosen vessel to bring the Messiah to this world. And so there's an allusion to that very thing that we looked at last night. So he made this altar using 12 stones, and with the stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord. He made, and by the way, notice there, the word Lord, and this is probably most of the time in this section that we're looking at, if not all of the time, it's in all capital letters. And I've talked to different classes about this a lot. If I'm repeating myself to you, forgive me. But it's important to notice when the word Lord is in all capital letters, it means it's translated from the Hebrew tetragrammaton, what we call Yahweh or Jehovah. It's almost definitely not Jehovah, but it might be Yahweh, it might be some other pronunciation. All we have are the consonants. We've got four consonants, and that stands for the name of God. Why don't we have the full word? Because the Jews who transcribed the scriptures thought that would be taking the name of the Lord our God in vain. And so they would not write the entire name of God. And that's why we're not sure if it's Yahweh or Jehovah or something similar to that. But every time you see the word Lord in the Old Testament with all capital letters, that's what it's talking about. So when it says in verse 32, with the stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord, in the name of Yahweh. It was very clear what he was doing. This is not Baal. This is Yahweh that I'm going to be calling out to. And then he made a trench about the altar as great as would contain 2 seahs of seed. He put on the wood in order and cut the bull in pieces and laid it on the wood. And he said, "Fill 4 jars with water and pour it on the burnt offering and on the wood." I never do that when I'm building a campfire. Have you? Have you ever done that? If you raise your hand and say, "Yeah, let's go aside. We'll talk about this." You don't want to do that if you want to start a fire. So why is he doing that? Yeah, this wasn't just an accident. I mean, this would take miraculous intervention. I've been in those situations where it would take miraculous interventions to start that campfire. At least that's what I say. But, you know, he wants them to know this is more than the usual. And then that's not enough. He says, let's do it again, and let's do it a third time. Three different times, a large quantity of water is poured upon the wood and the sacrifice, which makes it highly unlikely there's going to be any fire in this pit, on this altar. And while we're thinking about that, where'd this water come from? Aren't we in the midst of a drought? Well, there is some water available, just not very much, and it's very precious. So do you think that maybe Elijah knows that this drought is not going to last forever and that probably very soon it's going to come to an end? But still, they bring it, which is kind of surprising given the situation. They saturate the altar and the offering and the wood. And then, of course, let's go down now to verse 36. At the time of the offering of the oblation, Elijah the prophet came near and said, O Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Israel, I'm sorry, let it be known this day that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and that I have done all these things at your word. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, that this people may know you, that you, O Lord, are God, and that you have turned their hearts back. And there's a prayer, a very fervent prayer, and we're going to connect that with something else here in just a bit. But he prays that God will hear his prayer and let this fire be kindled and the offering consumed. Verse 38, then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. You're talking about fire. You know, this is a high-grade fire. And it's obvious. This is from above. This is God's work. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and said, the Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God. And Elijah said to them, seize the prophets of Baal. Let not one of them escape. And they killed them all right there. By the way, I had a quote, and I erased it accidentally. But a quote that said that the Hebrew rendering of this statement of the people in verse 39, the Lord, he is God, the Lord, he is God, is very emphatic in the way it is stated, as if they are saying, he is the God. Yahweh is the God. And that's what Elijah's been trying to tell them. That's his name. Yahweh is my God. And now they are agreeing with that and saying, he is our God as well. So a dramatic victory on Mount Carmel, an amazing display of the power of God. But again, what we're focused on tonight, there's a lot of things we could focus on, but what we're focused on is the commitment of Elijah and the courage it took for him to do what he did in that situation. Because it could have gone really bad. Really bad for Elijah. He could have ended up as an offering on the altar to Baal. But what was the difference? Well, let me show you. In fact, I pointed out just below that in 1 Kings 17, verse 1, and in chapter 18 and verse 15, both times Elijah is making a vow. The first time it is to King Ahab, the second time to Obadiah, and he says both times, as the Lord lives. If you are convinced of that, if you know that God lives and that you are serving him, you can do things like this. That's the basis of his commitment. It's also the basis of our commitment as well. You know, if you're not really certain, and that's where we've got to really work at strengthening our faith and questioning ourselves and saying, is this really what I believe and why do I believe it? There is a God in heaven, and I will stand before him one day, and he has given his son to die for me, and he loves me, and he's offered to help me in situations that I think are very scary. Then we can have that same kind of commitment if we have that same assurance that Elijah had. Any questions or comments to this point? Got a little bit more I'll say, but I'd like to hear what you have, if you have anything you'd like to throw in here. Yes, Danny. Yeah, could they imagine doing what he was doing? And I think they probably came thinking, well, we're going to see some blood. This man is crazy, and he'll end up being sacrificed to Baal or one of the gods. I really think that's probably why a lot of them were there, like the gladiators, you know, the people of Rome. Let's go see somebody else get killed. Linda. Yeah, by this time, any altars to God, and of course, God only authorized the one altar at the temple, but you read about altars being built in other places by good people, and so if there were any, they had probably long since been torn down. It looks like Jezebel is on a mission to purge the land. Yes, Danny. Yeah, in fact, I'm not going to talk about that part of it tonight. That's, you know, something beyond what we're here to talk about. But we'll just mention that, you know, it's after this that Jezebel says, this time tomorrow, you know, you're not going to be alive, in essence. And he runs. You know, it's kind of mind-boggling, isn't it? He stood up to King Ahab and the 850 prophets and all the people. And now Jezebel makes a threat and he runs. Probably he has been so exhausted by the stress of the situation. I mean, it's not an uncommon reaction, I think. When you have gotten something really big out of the way in your life, you just limp for a while and you're not really able to take on anything. Yeah. Yeah, he didn't believe his life was any value. In fact, he thought he was the only one left. And why are you letting her threaten me, Lord? You should have taken care of her too, maybe. But yeah, there was a lot of depression, I think. And God is very gentle with him, isn't he? He says, rise and eat, and does it a second time. And then he appears to him, not in the whirlwind, not in the fire, but in a still, small voice. And these are such fascinating passages. I wish we had a lot of time to talk about them. But and we could stay, you know, till about midnight and talk about some more of it if you'd like. But yeah, it's a very interesting passage about what he does after this. Very puzzling. And yet I think it shows he was human. He was human. And James makes allusion to that. In fact, let's go to James now and talk... talk about what James says. Most of us are familiar with this passage in James chapter 5. You've already lost your place in 1 Kings, but if you haven't, hold on to it. James chapter 5, this is where James is urging his readers to pray, to confess their sins to one another, pray for one another. And then somebody read verses 17 and 18 of James 5, please. Thank you. So he begins by saying Elijah was a man with a nature like ours. Sometimes we miss that part. We think, Elijah, well, I'm not like Elijah. He was a great man. But James says he was a man with a nature like ours. He wasn't a superhero. He just learned to trust God more than maybe me. And that's what gave him the power to do what he did. And then he talks about the prayer and the effectiveness of that prayer. And we love that statement, especially verse 16. I should have had you start there. But he says in verse 16, the prayer of a righteous person has great power as it is working. And I know your translation may be a little different from that. But the way it's worded and a word that is used in the Greek, and I've read this in a couple of different scholars. That's another in the notes that I accidentally deleted. But it's a way of saying that it's our prayers that accesses God's power, and that's what makes the difference. And I believe that, don't you? Do you believe it's your prayer that has the power? Or do you believe it's God's power that has the power? Well, I think obviously it's God's power that has the power. Yeah, God's power is what works effectively. It's not my prayer. And it's not how many times I pray. It's not how fervently I pray. It's whether God hears my prayer. That's what makes all the difference. And if we go back now to 1 Kings, I'll show you that in three different passages. 1 Kings 8, well, I'll show it in a couple. 1 Kings 18, we didn't go this far, we should have, verses 41 through 46, and we're going to finish in about 5 minutes, so we're winding it down. Elijah said to Ahab, "Go up, eat and drink. There is a sound of the rushing of rain." And Ahab probably says, "I don't hear anything." And for a while, neither does Elijah. But Elijah knows the time has come. So Ahab went up to eat and drink. Elijah went up to the top of Mount Carmel, and he bowed himself down on the earth and put his face between his knees. Now you remember, James said that Elijah prayed that it would not rain, and it didn't. And then he prayed again that it would, and it did. In 1 Kings, it doesn't say explicitly, does it, that he prayed. But isn't that what we're looking at here? I think very obviously when it says he bowed himself down on the earth and put his face between his knees, that is a posture of contrition. I think he is now engaged in prayer to God and saying, "Lord, the people have learned a powerful lesson. Bless them with rain." He knows the suffering that is going on, and he now intercedes on behalf of the people. Now, what James is trying to do, by the way, let me point this out. James is trying to show prayer brings blessings. He mentions that Elijah's prayer first brought hardship, but it was his prayer that then led to the blessings. And that's the big lesson that James wants us to learn. And that's what we're seeing here, because it's after he bows himself, puts his face between his knees, which, by the way, I wouldn't try until you consult with your orthopedic doctor. That could be difficult. But eventually, he tells his servant to go up about seven times. And then in verse 44, the seventh time he said, "Behold, a little cloud like a man's hand is rising from the sea. Well, go tell Ahab, prepare your chariot and go, lest the rain stop you." And now the rain begins, and there is evidently a deluge, and they all go back to the palace now. But that shows that God responded to the prayer of Elijah. You could also see that back in chapter 17. We didn't read that about the widow of, what's the name of the place again? Zarephath. The widow of Zarephath who had the little boy, he died. She comes to Elijah, says, "What have you done to me? Have you brought my sin out?" And he takes the child and prays to God for the child, who obviously is dead. Look at verse 22 of chapter 17. The Lord listened to the voice of Elijah. The Lord listened to the voice of Elijah, and the life of the child came into him again, and he revived. It does not say that after Elijah prayed hard, the child came back to life. He may have prayed hard, but it was when God listened to him that the miracle took place. And again, it simply points out, we've got to do our part, no doubt. I'm not minimizing prayer in any way, but never think, my prayers did the trick. No, it's God. It's his power that does the trick. And it's our prayers that access that prayer, that power. I say prayer and power 50 times. Okay, I'm going to close with this. And this is Luke chapter 1 and verse 17. Luke chapter 1 and verse 17. And again, we're talking about commitment and courage. And this is probably as good a way of showing it as I know how. This is the angel talking to Zechariah about the child that would be born to his wife Elizabeth. And of course, we know that child would become John the Baptist. And I have the passage down toward the bottom of your sheet where Jesus says, John is that Elijah who is to come. But in verse Luke 1:17, this is part of what the angel says. He will go before him, that is, before the one who is to come, the Messiah, in effect. He will go before him in the spirit and power of Elijah to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the just, to make ready for the Lord a people prepared. And there is a high commendation of Elijah the prophet, an angel saying, John, whom Jesus said, there's never been a greater man born than John, although the least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than him. But John, a great man, came in the spirit and the power of Elijah. Just muse on that. What does that mean? Well, we saw where Elijah didn't back down. Neither did John. Herod, he could see the veins sticking out on his neck, and Herodias beside him getting really angry about what he was saying. He didn't back down. And he didn't back down when the Pharisees and the scribes came out and he called them, you brood of vipers. You know, John was courageous as well. He came in the spirit of Elijah. Any final thoughts before we go to God in prayer? Yes. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there had to be a wild swing of emotions there. You know, at first they thought, well, Baal's going to come through, and he didn't. And, you know, despite what the priests were doing. And then Elijah gets up and he starts pouring out all this water. Hey, don't you realize how precious that is? And maybe they're getting angry. And now the fire from heaven. I suspect it was quiet for a few moments after the fire came down and devoured everything. But that spirit of Elijah, that was a powerful display, I think. Good point. Thank you. Anybody else? Yes, Sheila. Well, in fact, doesn't it say that? 1 Kings, at the end of chapter 18. Yeah, the hand of the Lord was on Elijah, and he gathered up his garment and ran before Ahab to the entrance of Jezreel. He outran the king's chariot. I assume he was in a chariot. Yeah. It would take God's strength to do that, wouldn't it? Yeah, very good. Lots of things we could talk about. Wish we had more time. Let's bow and go to God in prayer. Dear God, we are so thankful for this book. What an amazing book it is, Father. We know it is the living Word of God. And Father, every time we come to it, we see things we've never seen before. We are strengthened. We are nourished. We are given instruction and insight. And Father, thank you for revealing these things to us about Elijah. Help us to meditate on what we've talked about tonight, to think about ways in which in our own lives we need to have that spirit of Elijah, that commitment. Father, may we always serve you and fear no man, because you alone are to be feared. Thank you for your Son. for the relationship he has given us with you. Bless us tonight, Father. And please, Lord, bless these children. May they be taught well about these same things, and may they learn to be strong and courageous for you. Be with us, Father. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Tomorrow night, I give you nickels. No dimes, just nickels. Jonathan Nichols, tomorrow night.